And the very ferocity of the Albigensian Crusade, in which a million people were killed in the south of France and adjacent areas of Catalonia and Euskadi, or the Basque country, testifies to the importance of this to the Catholic Church. It was decreed, I think, in the year 1209 by Pope Innocent III. It was the first internal crusade, or the first crusade directed inside of Europe. And, of course, what we know as the witchcraft epidemics and so forth were also involved with this. They were destroying surviving shamans, midwives, herbalists, magicians, and so forth for the succeeding centuries. And so by the time the 16th century drew round, Europe had been pretty much beaten into submission, and the memory of shamanic ecstasy or of personal religious experiences, ecstatic experiences catalyzed by true sacraments, by the entheogens, had been virtually expunged and wiped off the face of the earth. And the theocracy would have succeeded in their attempt to really efface this from human memory had it not been for the fact that that in the 16th century, Europeans, or actually late 15th century, but especially in the 16th century, Europeans began to wash up on the shores of the Americas. And there they found the age of entheogens in full flower. It was as though they had gone back in a time capsule 1,000 years, or perhaps 1,500 years. And suddenly the entheogenic use of entheogens was state religion. It was common. It was an everyday occurrence.
So the proceeding was started to wipe that out in the New World.
Exactly. And so what happened was quite predictable. The Inquisition was established in Mexico in 1578. Well, the Aztecs, or the Mexicas, were conquered by Cortez's men in 1521, and their religion was very barbarous in many ways, but it also had a very beautiful and sublime elements. And the Aztecs were a sort of an historical aberration in Mesoamerica anyway. The other tribes around them weren't nearly as given to mass sacrifice as they were. But the Spaniards used their bloodlust for sacrifice as a pretext to destroy other aspects of their culture. And they branded the entheogenic communion as a diabolical communion, as a heresy. And the Inquisition was established in 1578. In the year 1620, I think the 19th of June, the Inquisition formally decreed that the use of peyote and similar plant sacraments was a heresy, and that the Inquisition would proceed against persons that continued using these sacraments as against persons suspect in the Holy Catholic faith. Those were their exact words. And it was no hollow threat. There were, from the annals of the Inquisition just in Mexico, and this, there were parallels to this in other countries, there were at least something like 90 autos de fe directed against the use of peyote. There were a similar amount for mushrooms and many more for ololuki seeds. And so this went on, and they attempted to stamp it out. Unfortunately, because of the Mexican Revolution, other political problems, the Catholic religion ran out of steam in Mexico sometime around the middle of the 19th century, and they really failed in their attempt to eliminate this. And it survived in isolated areas. But there are several prominent examples of this. For example, the Huichol people continued to use peyote, but they were probably from San Luis Potosí, originally from the plains, and they took refuge in the remote area where they live now in Nayarit and Durango, the Sierra Huichola, and now they have to make this lengthy pilgrimage to their original homeland to get peyote. But they had to hide out in the mountains in order to escape the persecution of the Spaniards and continue to adopt this religion. It also survived in the remote parts of the Sierra Madre among people like the Zapotec and the Mazatec and the Mije and so forth. And so I might mention, though, that the Protestant churches have tried to take up the slack where the Catholics left off, and they've been trying to stamp this out as vigorously as possible.
With the help of the Supreme Court of the United States.
And other elements. So the Pharmacratic Inquisition, while it was very successful in Europe, and certainly very destructive to the peoples of the New World. It did not succeed in destroying this completely. This survived as in a time capsule in isolated areas, waiting to be rediscovered and by the scientific world. And that's what happened in a dramatic way in 1955 when Gordon Wasson met Maria Sabina and ingested the psilocybin mushrooms. And he was prepared. He was looking, as he said, he went to Mexico as a pilgrim seeking the Grail. His interest was not in anthropological study. His interest was in learning what a sacrament was and trying it and understanding the essence of ancient religion. And so what the third phase of my theory is what I call the entheogenic reformation. And that involves this, what we're currently living now, a rediscovery of these substances for the modern world and an interest in archaic religion and shamanism that's really quite extraordinary. And it's not something exclusively of the Western world and only related to the scientific world. There are several, on three different continents, there are important religious movements, syncretic religious movements, in which nominally Christian religions have adopted shamanic inebriants as the sacrament in Christian liturgy. The example best known to us is the Native American Church of North America and the peyote religion, which began to coalesce in the 1870s, 1880s. It was first incorporated legally as a religion in Oklahoma in 1916, and surprisingly in 1994 was legalized on a federal level in the United States when President Clinton signed an amendment to the American Indian Religious Freedom Act of 1986, specifically legalizing this for Indians in the United States. So there's one example. Now, I say nominally Christian. Some would say that the Christianity in this case is only superficial, as Weston Labar did, or would say that it's only a gloss to impress the authorities and sneak it by the Christian right and so forth. But nevertheless, the stated purpose of the Native American Church is to foster the Christian religion with the peyote sacrament. And so you have the situation where the Eucharist is no longer bread and wine, but rather dried peyote or peyote tea. Well, now that's one example. Another example, roughly contemporaneous with that, is from Africa, from Western or Equatorial Africa, especially in Gabon. And this is the Bwiti religion, which started mainly among the Fang people of Gabon. And this is also, they've been subjected to missionary activity and so forth. And it's also a Christian religion in which powdered root of iboga or tabernanthi iboga is used as the Eucharist, very specifically in this case identified as the Eucharist. And in fact, the Bwitists even say that we are the true Christians, that the Catholics have lost the way that leads you to Christ. They've lost the entheogen. And this is, to give some numbers to this, the Native American Church of North America has, some estimate, around 250,000 members. It could be higher, but it's no less than that. The Bwiti religion has some millions of members, and it has achieved the character of state religion in Gabon. It became, the French colonial authorities adopted their own pharmacratic inquisition against it and tried to suppress it, and it became identified with the nationalistic anti-colonial movement, and so much so that the first president of Gabon after the French were driven out was a Bwitist. And now it's probably the most important religion in Gabon, and it's spread to several neighboring countries. In Gabon alone, there are 2,000 Bwiti temples, and they take this sacrament on a weekly basis. To give a third and final example of the entheogenic reformation of Christianity, there is the example of the ayahuasca churches in South America, which started approximately in the 1930s. In Brazilian Amazonia in the state of Acre. There are two main ones and several minor ones. The major ones are, the largest is called the UDV or the União do Vegetal, and also the Santo Daime. They're both fairly big. Daime is older, UDV is larger. And the Daime religion was started by a man named Mestre Raimundo Irineo Serra in the 1930s in Brazilian Amazonia. And this is also a type of a Christian religion in which, in this case, ayahuasca serves as the Eucharist or the sacrament. They call it Daime, and the religion is called Santo Daime. And this has also slowly spread and all over Brazil into urban areas as well. The UDV, or União do Vegetal, was started in 1961 by a man named Mestre Gabriel da Costa, and he started this rival faith to the Santo Daime. And in the case of the União do Vegetal, the potion is called Shawasca or Vegetal. Shawasca means vine tea, roughly. And like Bwiti and the Native American Church, this is a growing phenomenon, and it's spreading. It's legal in Brazil. There have been attempts to illegalize these religions in Brazil, two of them, by the federal government under pressure from the United States and other agents to illegalize it, and they have successfully resisted this, and it's specifically legalized, and they're exempted from the drug laws because the potions do contain DMT, which is a controlled substance in Brazil. And they are also spreading to other countries, including the United States.
So that is partially the subject matter of Jonathan Ott's latest book, The Age...
25 words or less.
In 25 words. The Age of Entheogens, and for no extra charge in the same book, The Angels Dictionary. All of the Jonathan Ott's books are published by Natural Products Company, and are available from Jonathan Ott, O-T-T, Jonathan Ott Books, P.O. Box 1251, in Occidental, California, 95465. And you can get a flyer from them on all of Jonathan's books. Jonathan Ott Books, P.O. Box 1251. Occidental, California, 95465, and that includes not only the latest, The Age of Entheogens and the Angel's Dictionary, almost said the Devil's Dictionary.
Well, that was my inspiration for the title.
And there's Ayahuasca Analogs, his previous book on analogs to ayahuasca, a valuable little book, and then Pharmacotheon, and everything you could possibly want to know about entheogenic drugs, their plant sources in history, and then a little wonderful little book called The Cacahuatl Eater, The Ruminations of an Unabashed Chocolate Addict, because Jonathan Ott is addicted to chocolate.
And definitely unabashed.
And you're listening to KPFK Los Angeles, and why don't we throw up the phones and for a while if you want to talk to Jonathan Ott. He is here at KPFK, if it is the 21st of November, 1995, where you are, then you can get through and talk to Jonathan live on the air. Let me see. Hello?
Oh, hi, it's really a great program, although I'm getting tired. I remember once before, Jonathan Ott spoke about the practical way of using the ayahuasca is through making it through a Mr. Coffee Maker with some lemon, something of that sort. You were supposed to have it, Roy, you were supposed to have it in the folio or something.
No, I wasn't going to put anything in
the folio. You were going to put some kind of, it's a recipe in the folio. Can you speak about that particular...
About the ayahuasca analogs?
Well, that's the ayahuasca analogs.
Yes. Right. Well...
Oh, it's in the book, you mean?
Yes. I can say a few words about it anyway. Basically what we call the ayahuasca effect, or the ayahuasca phenomenon, which was apparently discovered only once in history in Amazonia, and in my opinion is the most sophisticated pharmacognostical discovery ever made in the ancient world anywhere. It wasn't hit upon by the Chinese or the Hindus or the Europeans. Involves the fact that by combining two different plant extracts, and they're aqueous extracts of plants, you can make DMT active orally. DMT is a very potent entheogen, but it's by itself it's not active orally. It's effective when smoked. It's effective when injected. But people ingested up to a gram of it orally with no effect. And the Amazonian Indians somehow discovered that by combining leaves that contain relatively low amounts of DMT with bark or stem, pounded stems of the ayahuasca plant, which is scientifically Banisteriopsis ka'api, you could render DMT active orally. And what we now know is happening here, and we have elucidated this by human self-experiments or psychoactive bioassays, bioassays, is that the alkaloids that are found in the stem of Banisteriopsis ka'api, they're known to chemists as beta-carbolines, and the most important one is harmine, are inhibitors of an enzyme called monoamine oxidase, especially specifically MAOA. And once this ends, this is the enzyme that decomposes DMT in your stomach so that it doesn't exert an effect orally. And so if you combine these two substances or these two plants containing them, you get a potion in which DMT is active orally. Now, the significance of this as far as ayahuasca analogs are concerned is this. Neither the beta-carbolines from ayahuasca stem, nor the DMT from the leaves that are traditionally added to this in Amazonia that are called chacruna or it's a chacrona in Brazil. These are not rare substances in the botanical world. There are at least 60 or 70 plants in each category that contain these substances. And what we mean by ayahuasca analogs are combinations of non-traditional sources of these alkaloids. For example, Paganum harmala seed is used as a substitute for Banisteriopsis ka'api stem, and it in fact contains about 10 times more beta-carboline alkaloids than does ayahuasca, and from a chemist's perspective is a better source of these alkaloids. There are also better sources of DMT than the leaves that are used in Amazonia, some of which are North American or European or Australian or Asiatic plants. And so simply an ayahuasca analog is made by combining appropriate amounts of a beta-carboline source with a DMT or tryptamine source and making aqueous extracts. And the lemon comes in because I recommend using lemon juice in the water to enhance the solubility of alkaloids in water and minimize the amount of water. So that's, and this of course is explained in much greater detail in the book.
It was a little complicated.
It is.
Okay, well, it's in the book, the ayahuasca analogs. Thanks for your call.
Thanks
Ruben.
A lot.
I forgot to mention, Jonathan Ott is speaking tonight, November 21st, Tuesday night, at the L.A. County Museum of Natural History, which is in Exposition Park, as I recall. And he's speaking for the Los Angeles Mycological Society. He'll be talking tonight at 8 p.m., November 21st, Tuesday night, 8 p.m., L.A. County Museum of Natural History. There is an admission charge?
Maybe. I'm not sure.
Maybe not an admission charge.
I think there probably is, but I don't know for sure.
Okay, and what is your subject matter?
I'll be speaking about the Age of Entheogens, the Pharmacratic Inquisition, and the Entheogenic Reformation.
Okay, L.A. County Museum of Natural History in Exposition Park, and 8 o'clock p.m. tonight, November 21st, 1995. Hello, you're on the air with Jonathan Ott.
Yes, I'm sure it hasn't been lost on you that Ambrose Bierce also disappeared in Mexico.
Yes.
I dug out my copy of the Ayahuasca Analogs book to check my marginalia for questions, and As I recall, my main question was, I was kind of more interested in those species of plants that didn't have to be, how should I say, the source seed found and then cultivated. I was more interested in what might be manifest. So I was, for example, I was more interested in knowing about the beta-carboline content of tribulus rather than paganum, because that grows everywhere.
Uh-huh.
And also, for example, maybe DMT sources that would be readily available in the wild. Like the only thing I saw on your list that looked like a possible candidate was either a Rhododonax, or what about, for example, mimosa species that are very common in garden varieties like Albizia and so forth.
Well, I think mimosa is a good bet, but a lot of the common ones, or the one you mentioned, is not known to contain DMT. But one of the best sources, I think probably one of the most promising ones for the future, is a mimosa, Mimosa tenuiflora, or its old name is Mimosa hostilis. And this is known as
Yerbama. That doesn't sound very friendly.
No, well, it's spiny. I think that's why it was called hostilis. In Brazil, it's called Yerbama, and a potion is made from the roots called Vinho da Yerbama. In Mexico, it's called Tepezcohuite, and it's a very important ethnomedicine in Mexico, but applied topically to treat burns, and it's imported into the United States for this purpose. But it's rather the root bark and the roots that are used and that contain the high amounts of tryptamines. But seeds of these are already commercially available, and whether the actual root material will be made available commercially or not, I don't know, but I would be most surprised if it weren't so. As far as Tribulus terrestris, I couldn't comment on I don't have that data in front of me, but it would be a simple enough matter to experiment with it and find out. It is a good source of beta carbolines, and probably would contain amounts commensurate with Paganum harmala. It's in the same family.
They look alike too.
Yes,
they will.
But one should exercise extreme caution when experimenting. Now, Tribulus terrestris is used as an ethnomedicine. You'll find a lot of references to that in Pharmacotheon.
Also, I remember reading something where during one of your experiments, you pointed out that you didn't recommend prolonged heating, is what it said.
Right.
And the interesting thing is, I think it was actually during that conference a couple of years ago out here, I think Dennis McKenna showed a film of Yahe preparation, and it looked like they cooked the thing for hours and hours and hours. Now, why is that?
Well, it depends. It depends on where you're talking about. You get a full spectrum of preparation techniques in the Amazon, running from in the Colombian Amazon, they don't cook it at all, and they just make cold water infusions and only soak it for a couple of hours.
Mm-hmm.
In the Oriente of Ecuador, in the Sibundoy Valley, they tend to cook it for 4 or 5 hours. In the Rio Purus in southern Peru, they cook it for a couple of hours. And in the Iquitos Tarapoto area of Peru, they cook it for 12 or 14 hours. It's an all-day affair. Now, these alkaloids are not overly soluble in water, and the longer in water that's neutral, that's why I recommend adding lemon juice to acidify the water and enhance the solubility of the alkaloids in water. So the longer you heat it, and heating will, of course, enhance the solubility of these compounds in water. The longer you heat it, you would say you get a better extraction, perhaps. But you're also clearly getting degradation of the alkaloids from the heating. So it's a toss-up. Personally, I feel that just the ecological consideration decides the problem. It's definitely not energy efficient to heat it for 14 hours if you can do the same thing in 20 minutes, which is what I advocate using my more chemical laboratory techniques, just making 3 extracts, changing the water each time over the same mark or the same residual plant material, and using.
I wasn't disagreeing. I was just wondering why some of these tribes did cook it so long.
Right, I understand. Well, I think I don't have a ready answer for that. There's a lot of mysteries involved in this. There are a lot of additives added. There are different strains of ayahuasca that vary greatly in potency. Also of the leaves that are used for the tryptamine sources. We talk about ayahuasca, but we really should talk about the ayahuascas, because you have not only these differing strains, but about 100 known additive plants that have been described in the scientific literature, which may be used in various combinations. And so it's a tremendously complicated phenomenon. We've only, in a reductionistic way, teased out just the interaction between tryptamines and beta carbolines in these potions, but they also add tobacco with nicotine,
right.
Coca leaves with cocaine, various caffeine containing plants like guayusa and yoko, and so forth. And brugmansias that contain tropane alkaloids, brunfelsias that contain scopolamine, and we know nothing about the interactions of those compounds with beta carbolines or with tryptamines. It's very complicated.
Yeah, very interesting. So, incidentally, one of the ways in which I like to neutralize the word primitive is to pronounce it primitive.
Primitive, or primigenial is a good substitute also, and then it sounds like genial.
Thanks a lot.
You're welcome.
Hello, you're on the air with Jonathan Ott.
Yes, I was going to ask you,
Are you talking about this ingredients that from the tribes that gives euphoria to the people or something?
Pardon me, I didn't understand.
Could you turn off your radio, please?
Are these ingredients that you're talking about gives people euphoria, some sort of high or something?
Well, euphoria is one of the normal concomitants of the entheogenic experience, yes.
Oh, I see. I understand what you're talking about now.
Okay.
Thank you.
Hello, you're on the air with Jonathan Ott.
Good morning, Roy. Good morning, Todd.
Good morning.
I was wondering, okay, do you have any information on Shansi? Are you familiar with that?
Coriaria thymifolia?
Yeah, as seen here in of the jungle catalog.
Yes. No, unfortunately, we don't have any solid either dosage from ethnographic reports or chemical information on that. However, I would say that the probability is that the effect is due to what are called andromedotoxins or grayanotoxins, in as much as there's a well-known coriaria from New Zealand that was involved in a large outbreak, an epidemic-like outbreak of honey poisoning. And the source was traced to coriaria tutu. And the symptoms were very similar to what has been described for Shanxi in Ecuador. Giddiness, lightheadedness, the sensation of flying. It's especially associated with sensations of flying.
That's
Shanxi.
One of the things that really interests me, along with hallucination.
Right. I've been trying to grow it without success, not from seed. I tried to grow it from cuttings that I brought from Ecuador, but
here in California?
Pardon me?
In California?
No, in Mexico. But unfortunately, they were too long in trans and they didn't make it. I haven't tried to start it from seed. Have you had luck with it?
I haven't grown it yet. I have it here in the catalog, and I want more. I'm looking for more chemical, and also how many berries do you eat?
Well, we don't have, as I say, very specific dosage information, but the chemical references and information can be found in Pharmacotheon. You can just look it up in the botanical index
and go right
to the page.
And I was wondering, the last time I talked to you on Roy's show, this was, I guess, about a year or two ago.
Yes.
You mentioned this, I believe it was powdered cinnamon roses that you get at Indian stores.
Well, they're not powdered, they're whole seeds, but they're in Middle Eastern groceries, and they're sold under the name of Esfand or Ishfand.
Can you spell that out?
Esfand is E-S-P-H.
E-S-P-H.
A-N-D, Esfand. That's the name I've seen. E-S-P-H-A-N-D, Esfand.
And that's how I asked for it?
Yes.
Well, what did they sell it for?
For incense.
For incense. So what do you do? You grind up the seeds and...
Yes, you can get that information out of ayahuasca analogs.
Okay, and also is lysergic acid amide, say, from Morning Glory and Hawaiian Woodruff seeds, are they soluble in, are they really soluble in ethyl alcohol? I know they are in wood alcohol, but I was wondering, I'd like a less toxic route. Ethyl alcohol would be the way to go.
Why not just use water? They're soluble in water.
Well, I'm talking about making it into a yellow gum.
Uh-huh.
There's a way I have these instructions, but you have to use methyl alcohol. What you do first is you take like about an ounce of seeds, okay,
uh-huh.
and you soak, you grind them up in a powder, and you soak them for 2 days in about 100 cc's of petroleum ether. And the reason you do that is to get out the fat,
right,
the lipids and all that, and then you throw the liquid away, save the mush, let it dry out. Then you soak it for 2 days in 100 cc's of methyl alcohol, okay, and then you save that liquid.
So you're asking if you could substitute ethyl alcohol for methyl alcohol.
Say that again?
You're asking if you could substitute ethanol for methanol.
Right.
I don't remember offhand, but again, that information can be readily extracted from Pharmacotheon in the chemical appendix.
Right. Okay, so I just go to a Middle Eastern store and ask for Eshpen.
Right.
Okay, and I was wondering would you ever consider, you know, for people who want to just collect it, and I know it's in Pharmacotheon, but would you ever consider republishing Hallucinogenic Plants of North America? Because I would buy it.
Not really, because, as I say, the other book really supersedes it and is greatly more detailed, and I don't think there's much information. And I wrote it when I was a student. I'm not really...
Do Did you also write hallucinogenic mushrooms in North America?
Yes.
Okay,
well,
that's still available.
That's out of print also. That I would like to see reprinted, so if anyone's interested out there, I'll be happy to deal on it.
I am. And also, what about phencyclidine type compounds? I'd like to see...
I'm not really familiar with them. I haven't had personal experience with them. I'm more involved with the plant type compounds.
You're more right. And what do you think about iboga?
Iboga? Well, I have had limited experience with that also, but I'm certainly intrigued by it.
Yeah, and another thing is in mushrooms, the hallucinogenic mushrooms, the psilocin, psilocybin, those are DMT analogs, and
yes.
Those.
But they are orally active in and of themselves,
right,
which
right.
makes them quite
but,
different from
But if
DMT.
You smoke, on the other hand, if you smoke the mushrooms, then you can get the ones that are not, you know, that are only active through combustion.
Well, but I don't think there isn't any, no one's found DMT in the mushrooms, to my knowledge. There are other tryptamines, but they seem to be active orally as well.
There's 4-hydroxy-DMT, that's
you know, psilocybin.
Psilocybin.
Psilocin is 4-hydroxy-DMT,
yeah.
But that's active orally.
Right.
And it doesn't, we don't really know for sure, but it doesn't seem to be so active smoked.
Huh. And then there's also, I've heard that in South America, the snuffs, there's a pina, that's the one they
right.
inhale, but they also make snuffs out of some of the same, you know, species in that area, and they smoke it.
You're thinking of the Anadenanthus, and they're in the leguminosae family, the same family as mimosa. And the Anadenanthus contain principally bufotenine, secondarily DMT, and some other tryptamines. They are, in fact, you're correct, they are both used smoked and in snuffs.
And
they're active in snuffs. I don't know about smoking. I've only experienced them as snuffs.
A sensitive plant in the mimosa family, that's supposed to be active too, the seeds and the roots.
It hasn't been found to contain DMT or 5-methoxy-DMT, and there have been a couple of analyses published of it.
Huh, because High Times, in one of their, they had a section on tropical legal hallucinogens.
I wouldn't put too much stock in High Times for this type of information.
Well, it'd be interesting to check that out, though, to see if...
Yeah, sure, it's certainly possible.
You can, you know, try grinding up the seeds and smoking them or the root.
Right.
All right, well, hey, thank you for both your time. Take care, everybody, and thanks for the information, too.
Sure.
Take care now.
Hello, you're on the air with Jonathan Ott.
Yes. Well, I actually got through. Mr. Ott, I was wondering about the legality of some of these things in terms of, the plants, many of these plants are legal to be owned as horticultural items, but the substances within them, like lysergic amides, lysergic acid amides and other things in the Colton Fulford side, the Morning Glory family, are regarded as illegal to be used as such. And I wondered about that, and I also wondered about the legality of 5-methoxy-NN-DMT, was for many years, while DMT was illegal, completely illegal, the 5-methoxy form was available from places like Sigma in St. Louis, Missouri,
yes.
and other chemical suppliers.
Well, unless there's been a decree in the last couple of months that I don't know about, I've been on a long trip. 5-methoxy-DMT is still not scheduled in the United States.
Interesting, of course. The Sigma catalog for the past few years has listed it as a controlled substance.
But it says quite specifically that no license is required.
It's about 3 years now. However, I could find nothing in any of the federal codes about, or even state codes about any
yes.
specific illegality that was different than the wording of the law back in 1970.
No, it's neither scheduled nor is it on the watch chemicals list. It's in, and you could say the same thing for harmine, the alkaloids from ayahuasca, are in the same category. However, at the moment, Sigma, I know Sigma will not sell compounds like this unless you give them a written protocol saying what you're going to use them for.
Yes, the
even though it's not illegal and not on the watch.
Yes,
chemicals
okay.
is...
What about the legal practice of extracting and use? It was kind of put forth, because it's never been clear, when the lysergic acid amides and so forth that are in Morning Glories and Woodrow's were illegalized, but the plants and the seeds themselves, of course, were not. It was put forth by, it was not the DEA then, it was BN, Bureau of Narcotics and Dangerous Drugs. It was put forth by one of their officials that it was all right, in his opinion, it was all right to have the plants, the seeds, et cetera, but the moment you start to grind them up, mm-hmm. it becomes a felony.
Well, I'm not a lawyer, but your question about the legality of owning plants for horticultural purposes and so forth is a tremendous gray area in the law, and I'll tell you why that is. I think the approximate wording of the controlled substances law is that any substance, mixture, compound, or preparation that contains any quantity of the following drugs, and then it goes on to mention salts and isomers, and then list the drugs. But on the schedule, just talking about Schedule 1, where most of these entheogens are found, for example, you will find both mescaline and peyote, both THC and cannabis species. You'll find both, not in the Schedule 1, but in other schedules, you will find both, cocaine and the coca plant and both the opium poppy and its alkaloids, morphine and codeine. And in Schedule 1, you'll also find both cathinone and the cot plant. So one of the interpretations is if the legislature had intended, for example, to prohibit psilocybin mushrooms, they would have listed the species of mushrooms involved, even though they already listed psilocybin. So that's why it's a gray area. And the government has studiously avoided any kind of clarification of this. But in general, in the few cases that have been brought regarding this phenomenon, it hasn't looked good for the defendants. Generally, the courts have taken a fairly liberal interpretation of this and have said, yes, in fact, a plant is a substance, mixture, compound, or preparation. And it doesn't matter whether, that in some cases both a plant and a drug are listed and its contained drug are listed in the schedule. I would recommend there's a publication called The Entheogen Law Reporter that's published in Davis, California, that has always publishes up-to-date information on scheduling and on recent cases involving drug law, and so that would be a good resource to look for. I think you could probably find it in law libraries, or it's a newsletter. I think it's quarterly,
right.
$25. It's out of Davis, California,
okay.
The Entheogen Law Reporter.
What does this matter of extracting, which could be regarded as illegal, to actually go ahead and...
Yeah, well, clearly, if there's any extraction or processing involved...
Does that put you at risk personally as an author in describing how to do this and recommend...
No.
I don't know whether you recommend it or whether you use any disclaimer to that.
No. The information is still... more or less protected by the Constitution in this country, although it's on assault on all sides. But as far as individuals, once there's any grinding up or extracting, then that's clear-cut intent to violate the drug laws in their current interpretation. So while the growing of the plant, and in some of them, as you pointed out, are horticultural varieties that were already established for gardening purposes before they were known to be psychoactive, while that may be a gray area, extracting things definitely is not.
Okay, thanks for your call. If you want more information from Jonathan Ott, you can see him tonight, November 21st, Tuesday night at 8 p.m. He will be speaking for the L.A. Mycological Society, 8 p.m. tonight at the L.A. County Museum of Natural History, which is located, last I heard, in Exposition Park. That's 8 p.m. tonight, Tuesday night, L.A. County Museum of Natural History. If you're interested in obtaining Jonathan Ott's books, his latest, The Age of Entheogens, or his previous ayahuasca analogs, or previous pharmacotheon, entheogenic drugs, their plant sources and history, that biggie, or even... his ruminations of a unabashed chocolate addict, which has a lot of surprising information about chocolate. All those available from Jonathan Ott Books. It's OTT. Jonathan Ott Books, P.O. Box 1251 in Occidental, California, 95465. I'll leave that information at the KPFK switchboard. I'm sure they're available at Deep River Books in Santa Monica, and they're orderable maybe from bookstores?
Yes.
Published by Natural Products.
Book People should be distributing them shortly.
Book People. Okay. Well, thanks for stopping by again, Jonathan Ott.
Thank you for having me. I enjoyed it as always.
Mind-stretching session. And you're going to be at Palenque next
Yes,
January?
The second half of January. We're having seminars in Palenque through the Botanical Preservation Corps, which is a partnership between me, Terrence McKenna, Rob Montgomery, and Ken Symington. And we always have guest speakers. This year we'll have Sasha and Ann Shulgin, Luis Eduardo Luna, Paul Stamets, Stacy Schaefer, and Christian Retsch from Germany.
Okay, well, we'll all be sure to go down to Palenque in Maya land in January.
Great. I'll look forward to it.
Thanks. And this is KPFK Los Angeles. Coming up, we're going to go to Palenque, as a matter of fact, last year at Palenque, as we look at entheogenic plants on Something's Happening.